The communication feels incredibly rich, and I feel like I'm able to be much more of myself with my colleagues here at Dharma Chakra than I've ever had at work. So maybe it's not the whole picture to say, well, it's remote.
Benti, quite a few times in the past, had said that the tulip in the West was the equivalent for him of the lotus in the East.
You don't plant trees for yourself. You plant for the future. Dharma is for the future. This has to do with planting to help avoid climate change. This has to do with providing habitat for these birds who are doomed to extinction if we don't do something about it. So it's giving back to the world, the dharmic principle of generosity, and also of doing no harm. It's not just do no harm, it's actively do something good. It's not enough to sit back and say, I'm not doing anything.
I always think of it as a euphoric place. There's a holiday atmosphere all the time in Sydney. Where the Sydney Buddha Centre is, in Newtown, it's a very lively part of the city.
I've often had this sort of sense of the order being like under one tree and us being able to talk through an issue in depth and really listen to everyone's voice, but really note where the wisdom is.
We're experimenting with different things because we really want to establish the Vajrabell as the publication in Canada and the US.
The main inspiration for the convention was to, more like an experiment really, to have some forum spaces where we could have some conversation and debate and listening about things that are important in the order, some of the more difficult things as well as some of the more inspirational things.
Welcome to the Buddha Centre Online Magazine podcast. I'm Sadaya Sihi. It's been busy these last couple of months with lots of different events happening around Tri Ratna. The Tri Ratna International Gathering, the International Council, the Pan-American Order Convention, ordinations in New Zealand, India, Mexico, and the final Young Buddhists Big One. You can find out more about all these events on the Buddha Centre online. One important event that recently took place was the first anniversary of the death of Urgyen Sangharakshita, the founder of the Tri Ratna Buddhist community and order. And you can check out the Sangharakshita Memorial Space for more, thebuddhacenter.com/Sangharakshita. So the first offering in this podcast is about the Urgyen tulip, which was named after Sangharakshita. Akasa Shuri, who's based at the Metavihara Retreat Center in the Netherlands, tells us about the genesis of this idea, which first emerged in 2003.
I think it was Faramitra Manigarba and myself, all three live in Holland, and we were trying to think of ideas of fundraising so that we can open our own retreat center for the Low Countries, Holland and Belgium. And all three of us were on the board of Metavihara together with Dhammaketu from Belgium and Karin Emitra from Holland. I think it was Manigarba and Varamitra who came up with the idea. We wanted to name a tulip after Bente because we liked the idea and we all love tulips. We usually have tulips on our shrines when we have retreats, although less so these days because of the environmental issue. And we also knew that Bente quite a few times in the past had said that the tulip in the West was the equivalent for him of the lotus in the East.
What process is involved in naming a tulip, and how did they decide on Urgyen?
You have to contact a tulip farmer. There are loads of them here in Holland. We explained our idea and he invited us to come and visit his farm, which we did with the whole board of Metavihara. And he showed us around, and one of the tulips he showed us was the one that ultimately became the Urgyen tulip. It's a long process because when a tulip farmer starts growing a new tulip, he starts with bringing two existing tulips together using a brush. He uses the inside of the flower and then it becomes a new tulip and you dig it up around July and then you have one bulb and you put it away cold and dry from July till October, and then you plant this one new bulb and you hope that a new kind of flower will come out of it. Then the next year, the bulb multiplies in the soil and you have two. Put them away again for a couple of months and you can plant two bulbs. And then the next year, 4, 8, 16, tulip farmer can only bring a new tulip on the market when he has 10,000 tulips of a new kind. The reason for that is that when you breed a new tulip, it can easily revert back to one of the two original tulips. So you need to keep breeding year after year after year to be sure that doesn't happen and to be sure that the new tulip becomes strong enough as a new kind of tulip. Before you have 10,000, it's in between 5 to 10 years. And then once the farmer has 10,000 bulbs of this new kind of tulip, the tulip has to have a name before he can bring it on the market. He can either name the tulip himself, but it costs 3,000 euros, or someone in society approaches the farmer and says, can we name a tulip after my deceased mother, a famous person, or, like in our case, our teacher Ergyen Sangharakshita. We came up with the name Karuna because we all felt that one of Sangharakshita's main contributions to the modern world was giving us the Metta Bhavana and the other Brahma Viharas. Metta is a very short name, so we were looking at the three other Brahma Vihara names, Karuna, Mudita and Upeksha. And then we made a link with Benti's emphasis on compassion, trying to relieve the suffering in the world as an order and as a movement by bringing the Dharma to people. So out of that compassion, we thought we'll give it the name Karuna. When we put the name to the tulip naming board, it's a similar process as when you give somebody a name for ordination. It has to follow certain rules. When we said we wanted the name Karuna, we had a no from the naming board because there was already a tulip called Karuni and that was too similar. Then we put three names, which I can't remember anymore, to Sangharakshita to choose from or to come up with a name himself. And he almost the same day or the next day replied immediately saying he'd love it to be named Ergyen. And we were very pleased with that name. We put it to the tulip naming board and they agreed. So then the Ergyen tulip was born. It's one of the few tulips that gives us a subtle flavor, which reminded us of the flavor of compassion. Secondly, also for Bente, the tulip in the West is an equivalent of the lotus in the East. And Bente knows a lot about tulips. We wanted to give him the book called Tulip, but he already had it, read it from cover to cover. He was telling us, don't you think that the tulip originated in Holland? Because it originated in Turkey. And the third reason why we wanted this particular tulip was because it has a lot of petals, more than the usual tulips. And that reminded us of the thousand-petaled lotus.
Given that the Ergyen tulip was intended not just to honour Sangharakshita, but raise funds for the Metta Vihara Retreat Centre, how successful was it?
We sold 5,000 tulips, bulbs, so we raised about 5,000 euros for Metta Vihara, which was very, very good. And the lovely thing about it was that the tulip traveled all over the world, so it's been planted in America, in New Zealand, in France, in Dublin, in the UK, and of course in Holland and Belgium.
Unfortunately, Ergyen tulips are hard to come by at the moment. I asked Akasashuri about the plans to make them available again.
We want to restart growing the tulip bulb. There are 20 bulbs left of it, we found out, mainly in the UK and some in Paris, and they are brought over this summer to Holland, and then in the autumn you're going to plant them somewhere in the garden at Metavihara and start growing them again, and then hopefully other centers and other retreat centers and perhaps even Adustana can plant the Ergun tulip again.
Well, here's hoping. We'll keep you updated if there's more news on the Ergun tulip. But now to move from tulips to trees. Back in August, during the UK and Ireland Order Convention at Wyndham, I spoke with Shraddha Dharma, who is based in Hawaii. She is, in fact, the only person in our community in Hawaii, and she's been living there for the past 14 years. She told me about a wonderful initiative that she is involved in, the Triparvata Project.
A tree obviously is three, like Tri Ratna, and Triparvata is three mountains. I bought 85 acres of land in 2011, at the 4,500 foot level, which in Hawaii is fairly high up, is in a very cool range. And on that 85 acres, one of the things that struck me was I could see three of the sacred mountains that make up the island of Hawaii. Three is also a very significant number in Buddhism. So I asked a friend who is well-versed in Sanskrit to help me come up with a name, and we came up with Triparvata, three mountains. The 85 acres that I purchased used to be ranch land. The whole area, the whole region there was part of Hokukenu Ranch, which used to be a cattle ranch. It had been clear cut and used for cattle grazing for many, many decades. And about 10 years ago, I think, there was a major fire on the property, which destroyed what remaining trees there were. Well, there's actually a few trees left, but most of it was pretty badly damaged. The land used to be, back in the good old days, 100 and something years ago, it was a koa forest. Koa is a tree, it's also known as Hawaiian mahogany, it's a native tree. It's very, very beautiful and had been clear cut out. In addition, there was a kind of tree on the property, throughout the region as I say, called mamane, which is the food source for an endangered species of bird called the palila. And there has been an effort underway to reforest regions of the mountains of Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea. My property is on Mauna Loa, in order to help provide habitat for the palila. So I actually didn't buy the land with that intent. I bought the land originally because I wanted to build a cabin for myself to do solitary meditation. I was looking for a much smaller piece of property, 5 to 10 acres. The 85 acres just sort of happened serendipitously. It was very strange. Then I found out about all this reforestation effort that was going on, and that seemed like the right thing to do. It's going to be a 10-year project, and the first year is infrastructure. The first year involves fencing the entire property. It's 2 acres of fencing in order to keep out animals that would eat the seedlings. So at the time, there were horses, which have now been taken care of by the owner. There were cattle, which are now fenced in by the owner. There's actually one llama still wandering around who they couldn't catch. Yeah, all the other llamas are now fenced in by the person who owns them. But there still are wild sheep, wild goats, wild pigs just wandering. 2 miles of fencing is a very expensive proposition. So I applied for and finally got my grant. That's a long and interesting process. I'm not somebody who's ever done anything like that before. I've had to learn grant language. I've had to learn forestry language. I've learned a lot more about fencing than I ever knew even existed. So this year is my infrastructure year. I got the grant. The first thing that we did was we put up a 20,000 gallon water tank because there's not that much rainfall up at the 4,500 foot level in that area. And we put some water in it to get it started. We're hoping that we'll get enough catchment to continue. There are no resources up there. There's no electricity, no water, nothing. And the fencing part has started. I was hoping we'd be further along by now, but things just take the time that they take. So the fencing is ongoing right now. Next year, we will start planting little trees.
And that's where the project was at in August. Shraddha Dharma has since been in touch to say that the fence and water tank are now completed, so things are moving along. But what inspired Shraddha Dharma to get involved in a reforestation project when she originally intended only to build a solitary cabin?
I think that this is part of a way to give back to the world. You don't plant trees for yourself. I'm 65 years old. I'll be 66 in December. I will not live to see my forest grow. That's just a fact. I will live to see some of the trees reach maybe 10 feet high. But you plant for the future. Donna is for the future. This has to do with planting to help avoid climate change. This has to do with providing habitat for these birds who are doomed to extinction if we don't do something about it. So it's giving back to the world. I have an obligation. I have the means to do that. I have the energy to do that. So therefore, I have the obligation to do it. And that definitely comes out of our principle, the Dharmic principle of generosity. And also doing no harm. It's not just do no harm, it's actively do something good. It's not enough to sit back and say, I'm not doing anything.
So one of Shraddha Dharma's motivations in setting up this project has been to address climate change and loss of biodiversity. Climate change featured strongly in this year's Buddhist Action Month, which is an inter-Buddhist initiative in which many Triratna Sanghas participate. It aims to highlight the altruistic dimension of Buddhist practice. In June, members of the Norwegian Sangha took part in an inter-religious climate pilgrimage. Clear Vision made a short film about this event, which you can watch on the buddhacenter.com/clear-vision. More recently, Taraloka Retreat Centre have declared an ecological emergency, committing to becoming a zero-carbon centre. They set out their reasons for taking this action in a declaration which can be read on the buddhacenter.com/action, and you can follow this space for more on this issue and others. Just to return again to Shraddha Dharma, who's based in Hawaii, I asked her what it's like to live somewhere so far away from the rest of her sangha. Here's what she said.
It's been very interesting. All of my communication with people is really through the internet. I have a very active, used to be Skype and Google Hangout. Now most of the communication is using Zoom. But I have a very active life in communicating with both order members, mitras. I teach a mitra study course. I co-teach with Donna Dasa in San Francisco. My chapter is online. So I have to make an effort to communicate with people, and people have to make an effort to communicate with me. But the people who have made an effort are longtime friends. I've lived in Hawaii for 14 years. And so I've worked out ways of staying in touch. There's no reason why you can't have an effective practice and effective communication even without it being in three dimensions. You have to be willing to put in the work to do that. I was given advice a long time ago that if it's somebody I want to stay in constant touch with, what I do is before we hang up, we make our next appointment. It may be that we can't keep it. There are always things that come up, but it gives us at least something to change. And that has been a key to communicating with people all over the place. One of the problems I have is that so many people are in England. It's a 10 or 11 hour difference. I have had to learn to be very flexible in what time I'm willing to meet with people. So that's also a key to communicating across great distances and multiple time zones is flexible. Everybody has to be flexible. My nighttime is their morning and vice versa.
Online communication offers a way for those living in more remote places to stay plugged into the greater Sangha. But what if you work remotely? So I work for Dharma Chakra, which is responsible for the Buddhist Center Online and Free Buddhist Audio. The Dharma Chakra team is spread across time zones, with Chandradas and Virialila in the US, myself in Ireland, and the rest, Jay, Kamalavajra, Samudradaka, and Lee in the UK. So here's an excerpt from a longer podcast called Working Online, A Buddhist Perspective, where four of us, Jay, Kamalavajra, Chandradasa, and I, are talking about what it is like to be part of an online team.
There are lots of right lively teams in Triratna doing things like running Buddhist centres or working in businesses together, but they're usually in the same place, working face to face, and we are not. And that's something we've really touched on all week. So does anybody have any thoughts on the particular virtual nature of Dharma Chakra as a team?
Yeah, I find this a really interesting area, and it was definitely something I was keen to talk about a bit more during the week, because I feel like I'm often asked by other people, well, what's it like being part of an online team, with the sort of assumption that it's lesser or not as satisfying as it would be if we were all, you know, working in a room together. And I found that interesting. For me, I suppose
when we talk about meeting face-to-face, I feel like we do actually meet face-to-face. We meet very regularly. Certainly, I meet very frequently with Chandradasa, and, you know, we have been having a weekly team-based right livelihood with myself, Will and Jay on Monday mornings. And that to me has felt really rich. It's felt really quite satisfying. I guess some of what we have to work with is bringing in our imagination a bit more to fill in the fact that I won't ever be handing over a cup of tea to somebody, which I would be doing if we were working in the same office. But there's still really meaningful communication going on. Maybe another challenge is around sometimes when you're working in the same room with other people, you can spark off their motivation. But again, I think you can work around that by just having more of a sense of the mythic. I think that's what we're called to have, be much more in touch with our vision of why we're doing this. And I know that's something that we've talked a bit over the last few months in our team-based right livelihood meeting, you know, trying to stay in touch with the vision. But also for me, as I said before, I've just been really appreciative of the fact I've been able to stay in Dublin. While I wanted to work with Buddhists, I didn't want to have to move to the UK. I really wanted to stay and help benefit my Sangha, the Sangha where I first came across the Dharma. So it's just really wonderful being able to stay where I am, be connected with my local Sangha, but also have a really meaningful contact with others who want to do the same.
I mean, one thing that strikes me was the first time I met Samudradaka, actually, and he quite kindly came to Bristol. I remember meeting him off the train, and this had been off the back of maybe a year and a half of a very regular video calls to Samudradaka, talking about the technical and nuts and bolts of things that had been going on. And I just immediately, I was kind of struck by this initial thought of, okay, this is the first time we've met up in person, but also these real feelings that I'd cultivated of gratitude, of kind of friendship. And I just remember being so excited, actually, so excited to physically being in the same place. So, you know, I could offer to get a coffee, hand the coffee over. And it really struck me that the fact we were video calls and the fact that it was so regular, which is something I don't normally get to do with a lot of my friends, actually, you know, speak so regular daily, it really built up to something quite effective.
There's a certain flexibility as well, isn't there, that having an online team allows that might actually not exist with the kind of, in quotes, in-person bricks and mortar space. It's like, we can be quite flexible around what people need to have an effective working life. And I'm guessing in terms of being a parent, that must be at least helpful.
Yeah, definitely. One of the other things that I can think of, actually, is we also get a little bit of a glimpse inside each other's personal space that you don't get. And I remember it's quite nice. I think I remember, you know, speaking to Chandradasa, and every now and again, Laura will come in and hand you a coffee or hand you a drink. And you'd be like, hello, and you get a nice little wave. And there's something, you know, you don't tend to get that. It's a little bit of a glimpse inside some space that's really beautiful, meeting a wider, you know, friends and family that happen to be around you, and you say Juliet comes in, and that feeds into my practice, actually, you know, very really, is that, you know, I'm working, I'm trying to get something done, and then, oh, there's a 1, 2, 3, now a 4-year-old child, yeah, coming in, and we can't control all these things. Just letting them in has been very good.
It's quite an interesting time for me, because for the last 6 months I've been coming into the office with Will at his house, so I have some of the team remote online and Will here in person, but I'm about to go into 7 weeks of being remote and on my own, so I'm paying particular attention at the kind of listening to, in particular, Sadhya Sihi talking about kind of her experiences of being remote and some of the things that are important in work. I'm sort of feeling quite interested about what the experience is going to be like for me over the next 7 weeks. And it will be really the first time I will be working like that. But also another thing that seems really clear to me, reflecting on it this week, is I've been in all these office situations with maybe 50, 60 other colleagues, and in particular, always in teams where they try and have your immediate team of 5, 6 people sat really shoulder to shoulder to facilitate that kind of communication. But actually, it's very clear that we're just communicating in a very kind of narrow way with our work personas, and there's so much you're not able to communicate. And actually, being here, although it's remote, we start all our meetings with quite kind of rich reporting in sessions, and we do it several times a week and have been doing it for months now. So the communication feels incredibly rich, and I feel like I'm able to be much more of myself with my colleagues here at Dharma Chakra than I've ever had at work. So maybe it's not the whole picture to say, well, it's remote.
Yeah, that's right. Well, one of the things that's been obvious all week just in us taking the time to spend more hours, as it were, on the kind of background relational side of being in a team together is how much appreciation there is of each other. And yeah, it just really struck that having a kind of whole sense of people's lives has been really important. We're not just showing up to do our work, we're kind of showing up as complete beings. And there's probably more to say about that, but yeah, I was just really struck by that. I carry that sense with me of appreciation of all of you as friends and as colleagues, which is no insignificant bit of it, certainly for me.
And you can listen to the full podcast on thebuddhacentre.com/features to hear the rest. So moving from the team who brings you the platform, The Buddha Centre Online, to another platform for helping build connections, The Vajrabel, an online magazine which features articles on the teachings and practices of the Triratna Buddhist Order and community. Sadavasini is the editor of Vajrabel. Her background is in journalism, business communication, and she's also been a speechwriter. Here she is explaining the evolution of Vajrabel.
Vajrabel was started quite a number of years ago, probably, I would say, about 20 years ago. And it really started out as a newsletter for Arya Loka. Although, in the beginning, it also includes some pretty in-depth articles about Dharma, and it involved in having more newsy stuff about what was happening at Arya Loka as Arya Loka started to grow. When I got involved a few years ago, we really wanted to engage more of the centers in the area, particularly Portland, Maine, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Boston Sangha, to get reports from them to incorporate that into the Vajrabel as well. This was just to give people a sense that when they picked up the newsletter, they could see that they were part of something bigger than just Arya Loka. We expanded that to include the Montana, the Rocky Mountain Buddhist Center, the Seattle Buddhist Center, the San Francisco Buddhist Center, and also the center in Vancouver. So we developed a correspondence network, so we started to engage them more. And so it became more and more of a national U.S.-Canada publication. And we typically feature a theme, such as generosity, arts and the Dharma, how do you deal with today's difficult political climate, those kinds of issues, how do you practice and how does the Dharma come to play in that, as well as connecting Sangha and having people sort of see what's going on at other centers. Vajrabel initially started out as a quarterly publication. It is totally volunteer. So recently it's been coming out probably, you know, a couple times a year at this point, because it's quite a production to put together, because we do go into depth into several Dharma topics and have been engaging order members to contribute from all over the world, not just here in the region or in the U.S. and Canada. You can find it on the Buddhist Center Online /Vajra-Bell. It's difficult to be in publishing these days with a print publication. Most of what we do is online, but we also try to see if different centers can print copies as well, because I think it's helpful when people pick it up, especially people who are coming for retreats or workshops or visiting the center on Friends Night, so they get to see a bigger picture of Triratna.
So it's mostly an online publication, but what kind of articles does it feature? And what's the latest issue about?
Experimenting with different things, because we really want to establish the Vajrabel as the publication in Canada and the U.S. So we're shifting a little bit from a specifically Dharmic theme, but to really focus on community, because spiritual friendship is such an important part of the Triratna Buddhist order. And so we focused on what was happening at Dharmadhara, which is the retreat center for the San Francisco Buddhist Center. So we looked at that community process of creating this incredible shrine room that they have. Dhanamaya has done a Phi Buddha mandala that she has installed around the property. And then here at Arya Loka, we have had these incredible rupas that were donated, and we talked about the installation of them and giving a little historical perspective of around ritual and community in that. So there's a lot of sense of community, sangha, in this particular issue, and really taking a look at what's going on at the other sanghas in the U.S. and Canada in terms of the growth that they've seen, the changes that they see, and the types of programs that they offer. Probably our most in-depth issue is arts and the Dharma. It was a really important thing that Sangha Rachada had talked about a lot in his teachings, is that the importance of art. And so there was Kirnada, who is quite an accomplished artist, who talked about her one-year retreat and the artwork that she did while she was doing that, and a number of more in-depth articles about art. And it was fun to do. One of the things that I love about doing the Vajrabell is that if there's something that I really want to explore, let's do an issue on this. The last issue before this one, it was on generosity, because generosity is a foundational spiritual practice. And what does that look like in people's lives and in people's practice? So we also asked the sanghas to think about what does generosity look like in their sangha. And there also was an issue in terms of these challenging political times. How do you deal with that? And we did an issue last fall that really looked at the challenges within Sri Ratna that continues to come into focus periodically. So we took a look at what does that really mean for Sri Ratna? You know, how do we face the shadows of our past and then move forward?
If you'd like to receive Vajrabell, you can sign up by emailing vajrabellsriratna, all one word, @gmail.com. And Sadavasini says they would welcome any feedback or to hear from anyone who would like to contribute to the publication. So now from North America to Australia. The Summer European Chairs Assembly meeting is open to chairs from beyond Europe. It's a chance for chairs to get together, discuss their inspiration and to share ideas. So at this meeting, I spoke with Samachitta, who's the chair of the Sydney Buddha Centre, about the Sangha in Australia. Here she is speaking about Sydney itself and giving us a bit of the history of their Sangha and their future plans.
People go to Sydney a lot because of the climate, which is fantastic. And it's a beautiful city. As well, when you drive around the city, it's just gorgeous. The way the motorways sort of weave in and out of the skyscrapers, and over the bridge and beaches and the ferries and the harbour, and you know, it's just gorgeous. I always think of it as a euphoric place. There's a holiday atmosphere all the time in Sydney, and where the Sydney Buddha Centre is in Newtown, it's a very lively part of the city. There's a lot of young people. It's actually, I have to confess, it's quite a noisy part of the city as well, noisy day and night. There's a lot of cafes and restaurants and bars. The history of the Sydney Buddha Centre, bringing it sort of more up to date. Here we are in 2019. I think what's been happening in the last few years is a kind of spreading out from Sydney. So it's no longer just Sydney and Melbourne in Australia. There are quite a few other places where there are Sri Ratna activities. So even in Sydney itself, there's a lot of activity going on in Coogee, out in the eastern beaches. And out west in a place called Westmead, there are a lot of classes and courses being led by a very enterprising Dharmachari called Shantideva. And people have sort of moved a little bit away from Sydney as well. So some of the senior order members from the situation are living a bit west of Sydney in a place called Cobbity. And some others are living a bit north of Sydney in a place called the Central Coast, in rather idyllic seaside locations. And then further north in Kempsey, sort of halfway to Brisbane, there's another cluster, I suppose, of Sri Ratna people, of order members. So in quite a few places around Sydney and around Australia, there's been a sort of spreading out of the influence of the order. And that's just New South Wales. There's also pockets in Queensland and then down south in Victoria and in South Australia. And that's great, but I think there's also been a bit of a thinning out. And I think maybe we need to, again, come back to, well, what are we doing here? Why do we have a centre where we've got it? What do we want to do with the opportunity that we've got here? Do we need to put more resources into this centre, or are we just going to let it poodle along as it's going and keep going further out? I mean, my feeling is that we probably need to look a bit more closely at the Sydney Centre itself and boost it in some way. It may be that Vijayaloka, the retreat centre, is the place where that might happen, which is about an hour south of Sydney. And at the moment there's quite a lot of interest among some of the order members in building a stupa there. It's an idea that's been around for maybe 10 years, maybe longer, to build a stupa at Vijayaloka. And there are plans for it. There are architectural plans for the stupa itself and for some refurbishments at the retreat centre, which would really improve it. But I think that needs to be kind of located within a general review of what our Sangha needs and where the energy should go. So that could be the next focal point, or it may be that something else needs to happen first. I don't know, but I think we need to have that conversation and start looking at it as a Sangha. The other thing is that we need to do something about the pathways through the Sangha. At the moment, the most well-attended classes are the two study nights for men and for women. We need to somehow connect up better how people move from first initial drop-in to those study nights and on, you know, ordination training. Centres are a fine mosaic of people doing different things at different levels of involvement. It's not as though you come along for a while and get taught and then suddenly you're in and you're a teacher. I think there's different levels of involvement all along the way where you can give back. In fact, you can give back right from the start in some way. And I think people really would like to do that. They would like to have a role where they're helping other people experience the benefits that they've experienced at the centre.
The summer ECA took place this year at Padmaloka, the men's retreat centre near Norwich in the UK, a long way then from Sydney. I asked Samachitta what she felt she had gained from attending this ECA.
I really enjoyed the process. I've enjoyed the way it's kind of gone up and down, sort of ebbed and flowed. We started off in a very kind of conceptual, maybe abstract approach to strategy, and then there was a step back taken in the meeting. And the way that was handled was really lovely to watch, and also to see the response of all the chairs in the meeting. There was a bit of a turnabout early on in the meeting. And I've sort of thought we could do with that in Australia, actually. We could do with that in Sydney. We could do with doing exactly what happened here, as in broadening out, stepping back, taking a whole new fresh look at what we're trying to do or where we've come from, what our understanding is of what's happened and of what we're trying to do together. I'd like to find ways of us being able to come together and listen to each other in the way that we've done here at this meeting. It's been very well facilitated, and I'd love to be able to try that myself in Sydney. I think more about that climate area, that climate change area. It's been very useful talking to people here about that. I would like to get clearer myself about the place of climate activism in relation to the centre, or the place of the centre in relation to climate activism, because in Sydney there's a great awareness of the need to do something about the climate emergency. There is that awareness here as well, of course. That's why it's been in the air. We've been talking about it. They've done a lot in Sydney already in terms of trying to work against climate change. I think Sydney was the first centre to divest from banks that invested in fossil fuels. So the bank we use in Sydney is the Bendigo Bank, which doesn't have anything to do with fossil fuels. Just last year, or earlier this year, we got solar panels put on the roof. I mean, it's yet to be connected. It will get connected, and we'll end up with clean energy from the sun. There's composting, obviously, on retreats. Oh, and, last year we went vegan at Vijayaloka after a lot of discussion in the management. So we decided to trial a year of going vegan on retreat. That seems to be going well so far. There's also an ongoing conversation about whether to what extent we could apply that in the city centre as well. And lots of people in the Sydney Sangha are involved in the Stop Adani movement. So there's all kinds of activities, like going up to Queensland and actually encountering the people who are there trying to build the mine, trying to block it, basically. So sometimes I'm not too sure how well that fits with our mission, if you like, of spreading the Dharma. I'm not saying it's not dharmic, but how do we get the proportion right or get the perspective right in our activities? You know, making sure that the Dharma is for everyone, and so is the planet, of course. We all occupy the same planet, so it is a climate emergency. So how do we tread that line between activism? Is it political or non-political? Does it transcend politics? Does it even transcend the Dharma? Or does the Dharma transcend these issues that are live in the world today? I just feel somehow the Dharmic perspective is the thing to hang on to. I'd like to come at our relationship with climate activism from there.
So interesting to hear about how the Sydney Sangha are working with the questions raised by climate activism and how to respond dharmically. One other interesting initiative that's taking place is the setting up of the Oceania Chairs Assembly, which is for chairs in Australia and New Zealand.
When we had our first meeting of the chairs of Australia and New Zealand, I did write into the Buddha Centre online with a little article about it, and I called it the first Oceania Chairs Assembly. And afterwards, somebody told us that you can't actually call it Oceania because Oceania or Oceania includes islands that are not in Australia and New Zealand. But from another point of view, when you say Oceania, I think you know what part of the world we're talking about. And some people also like the mythic aspect of that. It seems for me to be connected somehow with Atlantis, even though it's in a completely different part of the world. But it sounds like something out of Lord of the Rings or Narnia, or it's got a ring to it for me of something mythic. Oh, we have to find hooks for our passion somehow, channels of expression for it. I mean, the passion is for the Dharma, but the Dharma in this area of the world. It's quite nice to have the little sister to the ECA being called the OCA. So, you know, and we are very much a little sister because there's only three of us who have been meeting and we've only managed it twice so far. I think we had a vague plan to manage it, to meet again in November. That's the chairs of Wellington, Melbourne and Sydney. So it's Sara Darshini, Danta Chitta and myself. I have so valued my meetings with those two. We have Skype meetings in between, but I've so enjoyed and benefited from being able to talk with them about Sydney and about the area and hearing from them about what they're doing also in the area, because of course they know the people. We all meet at the same retreat centres, let's say. And I think what I can offer too is the beneficial experience of having been at the ECA for quite a few years now, and just knowing what it is that we can do for one another as chairs. I think the main thing is friendship, really. You know, sharing best practice and peer support.
And about 2 months after my chat with Sama Chitta, Ratna Jyoti, also based in Sydney, was at the International Council, which was held at Adishtana in the UK. The International Council is a structure that helps maintain unity and harmony throughout the Triratna community by facilitating communication and consultation between the different strands of our community, the order, the college, and the movement. Ratna Jyoti introduces himself here and talks about the benefits of such a structure and how the meeting has gone.
I'm Ratna Jyoti here, also representing the movement, all the sort of 15 or so institutions from bigger centres through to various small centres and groups and right livelihoods and retreat centres in Australia and New Zealand. Definitely an advocate for the sort of structure that the International Council represents. This sense of linking up the order, the college, so the whole ordination process that the college oversees, and all the aspects of the movement, you know, not just the centres, but actually all the other elements of whether they're retreat centres or right livelihood businesses, trying to link all of these up. And it gives an avenue. This International Council does present us all of those different aspects, an opportunity to discuss what's happening around the world. Mm. So it's quite significant that we're coming together here with all of those perspectives, or people taking quite a high level of responsibility in all those areas, sometimes with not a lot of understanding of what happens in other areas. Mm. So this does present that opportunity to bring together a level of understanding about what we're trying to do and Triratna as a whole. So I do feel like going back into our area, it's very important to particularly have face-to-face conversations with people about what an opportunity the International Council is, as Vidyatara was saying, how the area council can give each order member a voice. And each institution with its struggles, it can be a level of support there for every institution. Yeah, definitely an advocate for the International Council. The fact that I think we're starting to gather more as an area council and gradually develop an understanding in our area, at least, of these different strands coming together becomes quite a strong resource for our area that we then carry into the International Council, but we carry back into each of our specific areas. So hopefully that resource becomes more palpable for people in whatever way they're involved in Tri Ratna. I'm really interested in communication, processes of consultation and decision making, and I just get a sense of how there's a level of maturity building in our order around ways and skills and qualities of consultation and decision making. And I've just been really impressed, particularly in the smaller groups, where order members are really interested in each other, in each other's perspective, and the level of inquiry that occurs in the smaller groups, where people are reaching out to others and really keenly interested to hear about their perspective on something. I've often had this sort of sense of the order being like under one tree and us being able to talk through an issue in depth and really listen to everyone's voice, but really note where the wisdom is and where those qualities that reflect the qualities of the Buddha are. And I'm just seeing more of that this time, seeing some people have reflected really deeply and have reached really considered positions on various things. And it's really, really heartwarming to see that.
So that was an extract from a longer podcast, which you can listen to by searching for Tri Ratna International Council 2019 podcast on thebuddhacenter.com. As mentioned, the International Council helps facilitate communication between the different strands of our community, the Order, the College of Public Preceptors, and the movement. One important way is through meeting in large numbers, which is the very essence of a convention. And this year, there have been a series of Order conventions around the Tri Ratna world. Firstly in Australia and New Zealand, then mainland Europe, the UK and Ireland Convention, the Pan-American Convention, and lastly, the Indian Convention. The biggest convention so far was the UK and Ireland Convention held at Wyndham College in Norfolk, which was attended by approximately 450 Order members. It was the first Order convention in the UK since Sangharakshita died. So here's Dasani in conversation with Lokeshvara, one of the International Order conveners. Lokeshvara explains the idea behind the format of this particular convention.
All of us were together in Bodh Gaya last year at the international convention that we had there. And we started to think ahead to this convention while we were meeting with the Indian Order convening team. And we started to think and reflect on some of the feedback that we'd had about conventions. And one of the things that was quite consistent was that people wished for a more consistent Dharma theme. And so we thought of A, providing that, and B, having one person to do the main teaching through the event.
Yeah, so continuity then in that Dharma input.
Exactly, yeah. So that was one of the main inspirations, was to also recognising that these days people's time is really precious to them, and people don't get that much time to go on retreats, for example. So to make a convention a little bit more retreat-like. Oh. So we've tried to make the programme fairly retreat-like for the mornings, so that there would be some Dharma input and a meditation. And then the other main inspiration for the convention was to, more like an experiment really, to have some forum spaces where we could have some conversation and debate and listening about things that are important in the order, some of the more difficult things as well as some of the more inspirational things.
One of the key dimensions of this order convention was these order forums, which provided an opportunity to discuss live issues. There were forums on conflict resolution, sadhana dialogue, order insight inquiry, safeguarding, next generation of leaders, as well as a forum which gave the Adhisthana Kula a chance to update everyone on their latest work and answer questions. The Adhisthana Kula was set up in 2017 to follow up and engage further with the discussion of issues mainly stemming from the early days of Tri Ratna, including concerns around some of the past sexual activity of Sangharakshita and some of the ideas that influenced people's behaviour.
And you chaired a forum about the current work of the Adhisthana Kula.
That's right.
You chaired that with Ratna Dharani. Could you just tell us a wee bit about what you covered in that gathering?
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a bit of a renewed impetus to that work that's mainly been sparked off by the article in the Observer newspaper, which was, I think, 3 weeks ago, which was highlighting some of the behaviours and harm caused by Sangharakshita and others in our movement in the early days. And we still feel there is some work we need to do to recognise that and address that. We spent 2 years looking into that. We realised there's still some things we want to draw attention to and some things that need completing. So this convention is a chance really to have some discussion and input from other order members on that work and about that work.
That's really good though, isn't it? It just seems with that article, that recent article, that those issues are still live. So just really taking that on as fully as we can. Yeah. And I think also that opening it out to other order members is important, because from its beginning, the Adhisthana Kula did a huge amount of work and held a lot, but really it is also the legacy of the order. That's right.
It's not just to do with the Adhisthana Kula to turn and face it in a way, is it?
No.
It's about owning our own shadow, to use that kind of language. Yes, so that's been important to do. And also it's a chance just to review the work that we've done and how we've communicated that, because what we're finding out this week is still that there are plenty of order members who don't know all of the work that we've done, so that's useful information too.
That's right. And in that gathering that we had yesterday, within that there was such a spectrum of some people who were making comments and saying, well, I really don't know very much about this, whereas other people were coming away from the forum going, well, actually I'd read what was put online, so I didn't learn anything from that gathering.
Sure.
Good though it was. So there's just a huge diversity and spectrum, really.
Yeah.
And I guess it's for all order members to, in a way, to work on having clarity around these issues.
Yeah.
You can read more about the work of the Adhisthana Kula at thebuddhistcentre.com/Adhisthana-Kula. But Triratna isn't alone in trying to figure out how to deal with difficult aspects of its past. The Generation X Dharma Teachers Conference in the USA focused on exploring ethics and power dynamics in the life of Buddhist communities and how we learn from the past as Sanghas and support each other well as responsibility is passed from one generation to another. And you can listen to the Gen X podcast by searching for Gen-X podcast on thebuddhistcentre.com. But back to the UK and Ireland convention. A feature of this convention was these order forums, but how did they go? So here's a bit of a vox pop of some of the participants speaking about how they found them.
I went to the Adhisthana Kula Forum, which I found, really wonderful actually, mostly because just how grateful I felt to those people, you know, Ratna Dharani and Lokeshwaran and Sadaloka, and doing that work. Actually, I'm so glad somebody is. And actually, they can't get it right. There is no right, but my word, are they trying? And I felt really confident in the work they were doing, and very happy they were. So I came out of it, even though there were dissenting voices in there, but I thought, I don't need to listen to that. Actually, it was a positive event. I'm glad I witnessed.
So, I went to the Adhisthana Kula Forum, which was very full. There was a lot of people there. I found the questions and the comments that were coming from people really helpful. And then a couple of days later, I went to the safeguarding forum. And it was good to split into small groups and chew over what we wanted to ask. So that was very, very helpful.
So I went to the Safeguarding Forum and the Next Generation Leaders Forum. I was actually really pleasantly surprised. I didn't have super high expectations. The idea of just getting together and talking about things that didn't particularly attract me. But I was really impressed at the level of communication and people's care and concern. And I found that really heartening, actually. I'm really glad I went. And, I certainly feel more confident at the idea, and I thought that there's a lot of potential for that actually, so really good, thank you.
So I went to the Order Forum around the Sadhana Dialogue, which was, I think, on Thursday. I found it really good. I'm very pleased with the approach that we are encouraged to talk about Sadhana. I wanted to learn more about it. But what was really good was I went there with my friend and we had a really lovely sort of try about the dialogue and it felt sort of something quite inspiring.
I found the workshop, the forum, really helpful. We were looking at the values that we want to see in any system or processes we develop around conflict and its resolution in the movement. And I found it very stimulating. And I also found the fact that we were very explicitly bringing in the Dharma values we want, a very helpful reminder. And we had a very interesting conversation about things like skills needed, attributes of people needed, as well as the fact that conflict's inevitable, combined with what's the Dharmic approach to deal with this. So in any conflict, have we got the skills to manage it, the people to manage it, and how can we personally work with our responses to and our own personal contributions to conflict?
Yeah, I think it highlighted the importance of keeping our Dharma practice at the centre of all of this, and that what was said towards the end was, in particular, that we need to work on our own inner conflicts and we need to look at our own darkness in the light, and that's very centrally important, and that we mustn't just be looking outside to outside agencies to come in with expertise and to have systems based on that, but we need to kind of somehow find ways of working through our practice to bring greater harmony. And I was very impressed that, Thiratna and Loka are looking to put a retreat on for mitras and going for refuge mitras and order members, to look at greater harmony.
I went to Sadhana Dialogue. I went to today. That was. It's always just good to talk about stuff with order members, and there was a very open but structured discussion that we could have in pairs, and then we could share with the group. So I enjoyed that. I particularly enjoyed the spring-fed pool. Which is really Dira Prabha's thing, just sitting from silence, Quaker influence practice, and I always enjoy doing that, so I went to that. I did actually go to the introduction to Order Insight Inquiry, but it didn't feel so much like a forum and more of a workshop, but it was okay.
I went to the Order Insight Inquiry, which I'd always been curious about, and I found it really interesting. It whetted my appetite. I think I might try and follow that through a bit, find out a bit more. Very interesting. I'm a quite heady person, so it seems like a good thing to get more connected with the rest of me and in the moment.
I went to two forums, one on conflict resolution and one on social change. Both interesting. Conflict resolution one was very good to just air the issues and hear from people who have got a lot of experience of that. The social change one, I felt that what it turned into was a debate about what is our model for social change. And I think it became useful, but it needed a while to get there. But it was interesting.
I went to a forum this afternoon, which was on Next Generation Leaders, I think was the title. So, looking at leadership for future in the order. I did find it useful. I enjoyed getting together in a group and discussing what we thought would help us in terms of leadership and what we thought was already in place that we did find helpful. And enjoyed hearing back from the other groups. So, it was good to go outside and do a group exercise together, just seeing where we thought we were in terms of leadership. So it's left me with quite a bit to think about.
So we're coming to an end of this episode now. Thanks to all our contributors. The opening music is from Blue Dot Sessions. You can check out and follow all our latest podcasts. That's Buddhist Voices and the Buddhist Centre Online podcast on your preferred podcast network. But just to finish with a bit of music, having mentioned the Generation X Dharma Teachers Conference in the US, Here's a little snippet of some of the amazing music that was played by the marimba band from the Great Vow Zen Monastery in Oregon, where the conference took place. A lovely way to finish. Thanks for listening.